Well, you can take your Bibles and turn to John chapter 11, please. It's a longer text, but I'm going to take the time to read it this morning. It's a story here that is, it's one of those stories that John, in his very selective process, chose to include with a lot of detail here in the 11th chapter of his gospel. So verse 1, begin there. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sister sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister Lazarus, so when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I am glad that I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, but even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. Verse 28. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here, and he's calling for you. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. So the Jews said, see how he loved him? But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Mary, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always heard me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the man who had died came out, his hands and his feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Now, the story here that John records has some very unique characteristics. Let me just point out a couple of them. First of all, the story is unique because it's the only time we see Jesus crying because of someone else's sadness. In other words, specifically because of someone else's grief. It's not the only time we see him weep, but it's the only time that I can remember that we see him specifically moved because other people are sad. And so it just pours over into the humanness of his spirit. We actually find him weeping, and he's deeply moved. That's the way the ESV translates it here. He's deeply moved. It says that on two occasions there when he comes to the grave of Lazarus with Mary and Martha. And you should remember some of the context of his relationship with Mary and Martha from other accounts we have of them in the Gospels. Secondly, it's also unique in that it's the only time we see Jesus specifically planning and preparing a situation in which he's going to raise a person from the dead. Now, again, it's not the only time he raised someone from the dead, but it's the one time we see him specifically designing the situation so that he can raise this man from the dead. There's a verse, and I can't remember exactly where it is, but it's where Jesus says, I Lazarus has fallen asleep. I go to awaken him. And I'm trying to remember, I didn't take note of it here, but as I was reading through, I remembered that he basically says he's very sick, and then they stayed there two more days. So that there's details there that Jesus is specifically planning to raise Lazarus from the dead. Now, if you were to sit down and read through the book of Acts, say, in one afternoon, it would be very hard to avoid this conclusion, Acts being the great story of the growth of Christianity there in the early church's time. If you were to read Acts all the way through, one of the things that you would come away impressed with would be the fact that the resurrection, at least for the apostles, seemed to be the great game changer. It seemed to be the thing that makes all the difference. I had a friend tell me one time, I said, I appreciate the emphasis that we have in our day on the cross. He said, but when I read the book of Acts, it seems to me that they're always talking about the resurrection. And that is true. So in the minds of the apostles, the great game changer, yes, it is the cross, but it's also the resurrection. And I think the reason for that is this, that is, if Jesus really did rise from the dead, if it's really true, physically, he came back from the dead. If it's really true, then everything has changed. If God gave Jesus new life, then it's true that he can give you and me new life. And if that's true, then it affects every aspect of our lives. Now, in this story, John 11, the overriding issue is the issue of grief and sadness. So we see resurrection, but we see it in a context of great sadness and great grief. There's mourning taking place here because of the loss of the life of Lazarus. It's on full display. Mary and Martha are trying to deal with it. Jesus is weeping. And it's in that context that he talks about that Jesus has something to teach us about resurrection. So I think you could put it this way. He wants us to see, I believe, Jesus wants us to see how it is that the reality of the resurrection gives us the framework to understand our own grief. It's not the only theme going on in this story, but it is certainly one of the major themes here. How is it that the resurrection gives us a framework to understand and to process, to really deal with, we could say, our own sadness and grief? And the reason is because sadness and grief actually have the potential to destroy us. They really do. And it's the resurrection that gives us the framework to avoid that and to understand what God wants to do in us, even through grief and sadness. Now, sadness can usually be traced back to three different but interrelated causes. I just want to mention them briefly to help us dig into a little bit the issue of sadness. We see them all at work in this story, so let's take a look at them very briefly, one by one. One, sadness because of loss. It's the first one that we think of when we think of why do we suffer, why do we deal with grief, why do we deal with sadness? Sadness because of loss. Mary and Martha are going through the painful process of dealing with the loss of a close loved one. Other ways in which loss comes into play would be loss of status, loss of health, loss of income, loss of confidence in someone, loss of a friendship, loss of hope for the future. That may be actually the most paralyzing way in which this sadness because of loss can tend to really work its havoc on us. Loss of hope for the future, for yourself. Sometimes it's loss of hope for the future for someone else that's very close to you. A second way that we see the issue of loss, the issue of sadness and grief at play is the sadness because of unfulfilled expectations. Similar to loss, but from a unique angle, when Lazarus got sick, the sister sent an urgent message to Jesus saying, "He whom you love is ill." And they had the expectation that Jesus would come and heal him because they had seen him heal other people. They knew his power to heal. And so as soon as he gets sick and it looks like it's serious, we don't even know if they sent for a doctor. It doesn't tell us. But we do know they sent for Jesus because there was this expectation that he could come, that he would come because he loved them. They knew he loved them and that he had the power to heal. So they sent immediately for Jesus. And later on, when Mary comes face to face with Jesus, first is Martha, but when Mary, probably the more emotionally geared of the two, when she comes to Jesus, she says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." That's in verse 32. And there was the expectation that Jesus would come and heal him. But in her mind, he didn't come quick enough. I mean, on the surface, he just didn't get there quick enough. And so the expectation that he could have come and healed him didn't take place. He dies. And so 4 days after his death, finally Jesus gets there. And in her mind, it was this unfulfilled expectation. Jesus didn't get there quick enough. We feel sad more often, I found, not because of something we had but lost. So that's very real. I feel like on a more normal basis, at least for me, it's the sense of sadness because I was hoping for something that never came to fruition. It's that sadness because of unfulfilled expectations. There's one more, and that's sadness because of loneliness. These are three categories that anywhere you go would typically be the primary three categories that people suffer. In other words, explaining excuse me, why we suffer with sadness and grief. And in this one, again, we see it played out here, and I think in a unique way. The sisters, if you think about it, were looking at a future in which their beloved brother would be absent. So there was going to be a sense of loneliness. You say, well, they had each other. But we actually know something about how those two interacted, don't we? We know from another gospel that they actually had some trouble getting along with each other. And so probably for them, it was the sense, I would assume that Lazarus had some kind of a role as the brother, two sisters that we know struggled with each other on a daily type of basis, probably two very unique personalities at play. Today we talk about the Martha and the Mary in the family because of those two unique personalities. There was probably the sense that there was going to be some loneliness because the brother was gone. And now it was Mary every day waking up to look only at Martha, and Martha waking up only to look at Mary because Lazarus would be gone. And so the sense of loneliness was probably setting in as well. There does seem to be in our society today a movement towards avoiding any kind of sadness. I don't know if you have noticed that. It's like if we accept sadness as a normal part of our human experience, then we must be really messed up or something. But that's a real problem. Because when a person never learns to deal well with the reality of sadness and grief, you look at these three categories, and in one way or another, all of us are going to experience them. And all of us, if we've lived long enough, have experienced them. And the future for us is that in one way or another, we're going to continue to experience them. And so, if it's just take a drug to avoid the sadness, or if it's go on vacation to avoid sadness, or if it's move somewhere, or if it's pursue something else so you don't have to think about what's causing the sadness in your life, whatever it is to avoid sadness, if that's the only escape, if the only issue is escape, and we never learn to process it biblically, then it actually isn't going to lead to relief from sadness and grief. It will actually end up coming back to much deeper levels of sadness and grief. So a man starts to drink to avoid sadness, and typically it ends up destroying him and causing greater senses of depression and sadness. I want you to understand that Christians have a tremendous advantage over many others when it comes to dealing with the issue of sadness in our lives. We're not immune to sadness. We also don't live like many people who avoid sadness as if it's a disease, a symptom of some deep psychological problem. Not at all. See, what we have in the Bible is a perspective on sadness that is grounded deeply in our understanding of creation, of sin, the person of Christ, and His resurrection. And as Christians, we understand where grief comes from. We understand this, the sadness we feel that things are not as they ought to be. We understand that it has deep, satisfactory answers in Jesus Christ and His resurrection. And that's what I want to help you see this morning. This story points it to us. There's really three questions I'm going to ask and try to answer as I unfold the text here briefly for you. Number one, how should we understand grief and sadness? How should we understand, as Christians, from a biblical worldview, how are we supposed to understand grief and sadness? Well, let me just go ahead and give you the answer and then help explain that. Sadness, I believe, is the appropriate response to many situations that arise as a result of living in a broken world. Let me say it for you again. Sadness is the appropriate response to many situations that arise as a result of living in a broken world. See, the reason that Jesus is walking around Israel healing people, have you ever thought about that? When he lived here, he was walking around Israel healing people, teaching them, and even raising a few of them, like Lazarus, from the dead. Why? The deepest answer is because the world is not like it ought to be. If Jesus had gone to the Garden of Eden before sin, he wouldn't have needed to walk around and heal people. And he wouldn't have needed to walk around and find dead people and raise them from the dead. But many thousands of years later, he's doing that very thing. Why? Because we live in a broken world. The world is not like God intended it to be. It's a world in which we experience the great blessing of God's creating and sustaining work. However, it's a world that groans under the effects of sin and the curse. So we understand that there will be great sadness in the world. It can't be otherwise yet. We know it's foolish to go around trying to avoid sadness at all costs, like many modern people do. So when you're tempted to think like a modern person, when you're tempted to think like the world around you, the sadness is somehow to be avoided at all cost. Give every kid a trophy because we don't want any sadness. When you're tempted to think that way about your own sadness, you need to go back and understand that sadness is actually the appropriate response to many situations, unavoidable situations, that are the result of living in a broken world. Let me direct you to verses 32 to verse 36. Because I want you to see something that maybe we haven't given a lot of thought to, which is the fact that Jesus, the Son of God, the God-man, actually, in his humanness, one of the aspects of that was the embracing of feeling the deep sadness and grief that are part of the human experience. Verse 32. I just want to read it and let you feel it. Now, when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." I don't think she's trying to manipulate him to pull on his heartstrings. I think, again, from what we know about Mary from another context, that is who she is. From John tells us she's the one that fell at his feet and anointed and wiped his feet with her hair. She's the one that wasn't helping Martha because she wanted to be there in the presence of Jesus, listening to him. Very relational, very, very much a sponge, soaking up the teaching and the communication, the fellowship, the relationship. And so there's no we shouldn't assume any manipulation here on her part. It's just her spilling her guts out, spilling out her heart. And so there in verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit, greatly troubled. John takes the effort to say it in a couple of different ways. Deeply moved, greatly troubled. He said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. And the Jews around him came to the conclusion, see, he loved him. See how he loved him. And so Jesus is experiencing what you and I experience. It's the deep sense of sadness and grief. The phrase that ends verse 33, he was troubled. The word literally means shaken or stirred up. The two other times that John uses this word to describe Jesus' emotional state are when, one, Jesus is thinking about his own death in another part of the book of John, and two, when he's thinking about Judas betraying him. So it's in this context, it's in the context of Jesus thinking about his own death, and it's in the context of thinking of one of the 12, one of his friends, betraying him. And so it's this sense of a troubled heart. And so Jesus' heart is stirred up. It's troubled. It's the sense when something is not right. And maybe like me, you immediately think of how can I bring an end to it? How can I bring a solution to it? And the reality is that there's many times that we have to endure, sometimes for an hour, sometimes for a day, and sometimes for a much longer period, an unsettledness in our spirit that just isn't going to get resolved right away, as much as we just want to get to a point of peace in our hearts. Sharon and I had a situation recently that for a 2 or 3 week period, we felt like there was constant turmoil in our hearts. And I think that's the sense that Jesus is feeling here. Also in verse 33, it's that phrase there, he was deeply moved in his spirit. And the word actually describes that Jesus was indignant about the situation. If you look in the ESV, there's a little note that points that out down at the bottom. There was some anger in his heart concerning the situation. Seems to me that John is describing the fact that Jesus was feeling indignation about the reality of loss and the sadness that accompanies death. He is moved in his spirit that things are not as they the things are as they are in this sin-cursed, broken world. In Peru right now, Lima, Peru has received in the last 3 years over 600,000 Venezuelans. Most of you are probably aware of what's going on in Venezuela. We have a little more firsthand experience of it because there are several Venezuelans in our church, and we live in a city that has just welcomed 600,000 of them. So we see them every day. And we see actually well-educated Venezuelans selling little empanadas and donuts on street corners. And you think, it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that they're living in shacks or three families in a small apartment trying to find a new way to live in a new country that is not theirs. And they're just trying to make it work. It shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that a few leaders can destroy the lives of millions of people. It shouldn't be that way. Many times if I go out late at night for meetings and I'm coming back, it's 11 at night, maybe driving back to my home, often I will pass street corners where there are children at 11 or 11:30 at night, young children begging on a street corner. And sometimes I look around looking for some adult in their life. And sometimes I don't see anybody. I know they're somewhere nearby, and it may or may not even be a parent. And I think it shouldn't be that way. And I know that if I give them money, it may go for food or it may go for drugs for their mom. You just don't know. And it shouldn't be that way. I feel a deep sense of sadness when people, and this I interact with all the time in Lima, people living unfulfilled in the pursuit of a better life, and they will not humble themselves before God and believe in Jesus Christ and His power to save us and satisfy us. Peru has experienced actually about 20 years of economic growth. The young people are all getting college education, which their parents did not have access to, and has brought along as well a pursuit of the better life. And people are giving themselves to that, and it is not fulfilling them because it never fulfills us. God didn't intend for those things to deeply satisfy us. And so anywhere you look, in all these different ways, there's a sense of grief, there's a sense of sadness, a sense of unfulfillment, not finding satisfaction where you seek it. And actually, if we're honest with ourselves, if I'm honest with myself, in my selfishness, I more often feel sad when I experience loss, or I experience loneliness, or I experience unfulfilled expectations, because sadness is the normal response to situations in our lives that are not as they ought to be, that are not how God originally designed this world. Let me put a second question to you. What is God doing then with our sadness? So what is God's intention with grief? Why does He allow it? And what is He doing? We understand it's a part of the broken world in which we live. And so we can't deny it. You can't just say it. You can't take, it's not right. It's not healthy. It's not right to take drugs to cover it up or to seek an escape. But what is it that God is doing with the issue in our lives? Well, let me put it to you this way. Sadness is not intended by God to lead us to hopelessness and despair. I want to mark a difference for you between sadness and grief and what we would call hopelessness or despair. You see, sadness is not intended by God to lead us to hopelessness and despair. On the contrary, sadness is designed to point us to believe in the One who gives genuine hope. And again, let me say it for you. Sadness is not intended by God to lead us to hopelessness and despair. On the contrary, sadness is designed, and I'm using that word on purpose, it is designed by a designer to point us to believe in the One who gives genuine hope. Now, excessive sadness or unresolved grief almost always will lead to hopelessness. In other words, sadness that just continues on and on without coming to some kind of a resolve, unresolved grief, will eventually, at some point, lead a person to hopelessness and despair. A few months ago, I read a biography of one of our former presidents, Harry Truman. He became the president of the United States a month before Germany surrendered to the Allies in 1945. So instead of it being Franklin Roosevelt, the one who joined Stalin and Churchill in Berlin in the summer of 1945 to work out the the situation about how would what would they do with Germany and what would they do with the countries that the Germany had taken over. Instead of it being FDR there, it was actually Harry Truman. And for whatever reason, before the conference, the Potsdam Conference began, Truman ended up being there with a day to tour Berlin. But don't think about touring in the sense that, say, our family went and toured Washington, D.C. this week. It was a war-torn city. And Truman, and I'm quoting what he wrote, he said, as they drove along the roads in Berlin, he was deeply moved, like, not the same, but like Jesus standing there in the presence of Martha and viewing and taking part in the suffering there. Truman wrote, there was nothing but blank expressions on their faces, talking about the people that he just saw walking along the side of the road, almost ignorant of the fact that a presidential entourage was driving by. Nothing but blank expressions on their faces, the Germans, mostly old people and children who appeared to be headed nowhere in particular. And he went on to explain that there was such a profound sense of hopelessness and despair that most of them didn't even bother to look up when the presidential entourage drove by. And Truman wrote that he was very disturbed by this scene. Wouldn't you be? You see, that's where grief without hope will eventually take you. A couple years ago, I really started trying to read a lot of Peruvian literature, wanting to understand what makes the Peruvians tick. I found that a lot of their literature written in the last 40 or 50 years is very depressing, because a lot of it's written from a postmodern mindset trying to understand the Peruvian and the years and years of oppression of the aristocratic class dominating over the poor class, the few dominating the weak, the many. And a lot of it is written from a perspective of hopelessness and despair. There's one guy, his name is Julio Ramon Rivero, and I keep reading him because he's so interesting and he's funny, but all of his stories end badly. And that's his way of describing the hopelessness and despair that many of the Peruvians have experienced over the last, essentially, 500 years. The very first one of his stories that I read was one called Vultures Without Feathers. And I read it about 12 years ago, actually, when I first moved to Peru. And it was one of the most shocking stories I had ever read. It actually made me a little mad. It's the story of a poor, cruel grandfather who lives, it's not a true story, but it describes life in a part of Lima that I'm very familiar with. It's the story of a cruel grandfather who lives with his two grandsons and a pig in a slum on the outskirts of Lima. And the story ends, sorry I can't give you the whole plot, but there's not much plot to it, except that the story ends with the pig eating the selfishly obsessed grandfather and the two young grandsons going off alone in the early morning to beat the vultures. They're the vultures without feathers. The vultures to the best pickings from the trash heaps. And that's how the story ends. There's no resolve. It's just despair and hopelessness. And a lot of his stories are that way. That's sadness without hope. And you know what? That is not the way the Bible tells our story. It is not the way the Bible teaches us to handle sadness and grief. The Bible is equally vivid in describing what sadness, even hopelessness, looks like. We do have some stories in the Bible like that one. You don't have to go any further than Judas Iscariot. He turns his back on Jesus, betrays him. Suddenly it seems to me that he's overwhelmed with hopelessness and despair. But because there is no new life in him, he turns around and does what naturally hopelessness and despair lead you to, which is to take your own life. So there is this deep understanding of the reality of the human experience of sadness and grief in the Bible. But the Bible points us beyond that to tell us that our sadness and our grief has a purpose, which is it is intended to push us to trust in Jesus Christ And where do we see it vividly on display? We see it in the reality of resurrection. And so here's Jesus, just to briefly summarize it in the story and then move to the last question. You see Jesus here, and he is permitting this sadness and grief. That's the thing I want you to see here. He intentionally, and see if I can get the verses right here, verses all the way back in verse 3 of the story. So the sister sent to him, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Mary and her sister, loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So it seems to me he's saying, because he loved them, when he heard that Lazarus was ill, you expect to see he went to them immediately. And you actually see the opposite. He stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. So what is Jesus doing? He is actually allowing the reality of grief and sadness to unfold and advance. Now maybe you say what I kind of said as I was studying through this, "Oh, but this is only, it was only going to be for 4 days. Anybody can put up with sadness for 4 days, right?" Well, two things. One, they didn't know it was going to be for 4 days. They thought they were dealing with grief and sadness as if it were going to be forever, in the sense that they wouldn't see him again until the resurrection, as Martha mentions later on. But I also want to point you to the fact that this isn't by any means the only story about dealing with grief and sadness in Scripture. Do you remember Joseph? And the grief and the sadness of loss, unfulfilled expectations, loneliness, they were all at play in the life of Joseph. And how long was that? That wasn't 4 days. That was a whole lot longer. And yet very clearly, Joseph comes to the conclusion that God designed it all, even though it was years and years. And so why does God do it? Because he is pointing us to rest in his sovereignty and to draw closer to him in those moments, and to rest in a doctrine and a belief that is foundational for our lives, which is the doctrine of the resurrection. You see, sadness and grief, I'll say it this way, are designed to point us outside of ourselves to a genuine hope. Outside of me. What does sadness and grief tend to do? It tends to turn us in on ourselves, doesn't it? And what is God's design for sadness and grief? To actually turn us outside of ourselves. To consider the hope that we see on display in the resurrection. So what is the hope to which our sadness points us? The last question here. What is the hope to which our sadness points us? And let me pick up in verse 20. And that is verse 20. "So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him. Mary remained seated in the house. And Martha said to Jesus, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you.' And Jesus said to her, 'Your brother will rise again.'" And notice how she answers. "Martha said to him, 'I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day.' Jesus said to her, 'I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die," I think he's saying physically, "yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Again, not necessarily physically, but shall never die truly. "Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." Now it is true that the hope that makes sense of all sadness is the resurrection. Think about it for a moment. The hope that makes sense of all sadness and grief is the resurrection. And you say, how is that possible? Remember, the sadness is usually related either to loss, to unfulfilled expectations, or to a sense of loneliness. And the one event, the one life event that brings all of those together in creating the deepest sense of grief and sadness is death, right? And that's where we most sense the reality of sadness. Why? Because there's loss at death, whether it's you looking to the fact that you may die soon, or the fact that you have lost someone permanently because of death. So there's the loss, there's the unfulfilled expectations. You looking towards your own future death, things you have not accomplished, things you didn't get to do, things you had hoped to do. Someone else dies, and you will never be able to do such and such with them. You will never be able to see them at Christmas time or... So there's the unfulfilled expectations, there's the loneliness that comes with death. So it is in death, the reality of death, that we sense all of those aspects of grief and sadness at play. So if it's true that death is the end of everything for a person, if that's true, if there is no resurrection, if there is no hope of a resurrection, then death should rightly lead to hopelessness and despair. And by the way, that is what a modern or a postmodern, a secular mindset eventually leads to. You should not be shocked when your secular neighbors, as they get older, tend to become more and more hopeless and more despairing of life and more frustrated with the reality of things. Why? Because if their worldview is true, then it would be right and natural to become more and more despairing the older you get. But that is not what the resurrection points us to. And it's interesting here that Martha believes in resurrection. When Jesus tells her that Lazarus will rise again, she responds by saying, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. She believes that God will one day bring her brother back to life in some kind of a future resurrection. But then Jesus does something very powerful. He tells her directly, I am the resurrection and the life. So I don't know exactly what it was for Martha, but somehow she was looking, I think, to the future resurrection. She was trying to find hope in that, but honestly, that's a little bit hard, isn't it? It's a little hard today to find comfort in something that's only in the future. And what we ought to, but it's a little bit hard. And what does Jesus do? He brings it back to say that resurrection will be possible because of me. And it's almost like, and you have me now. And so you think about Jesus and later on in the book of John, when he's talking to his disciples alone, John 16, 17, and he says to them, I must go. So there was going to be sadness, loneliness, but he said, I must go so that the Comforter can come. And who is the Comforter? It is the Holy Spirit of Jesus, of God, of Jesus specifically, that comes and dwells in us. And so what is the reality that the resurrection points us to? Specifically the way Jesus puts it here. If he is the resurrection, then one, it's the guarantee of the new life in the future, of the new life now, and it is the guarantee of the presence of Jesus Christ himself in us now. So when a Christian who understands this participates in a funeral, say, and the body is lowered, and he or she must turn around and then go home without that person, the comfort that is real and enduring and deep is that though I've lost that person or though that unfulfilled expectation may never be fulfilled, or though there is in our humanness a great sense of loneliness, it is that Jesus, who is the resurrection, goes back from the burial ground or from the point of sadness back with me and is with me always. And that's where the reality of the resurrection points us. So what do you do with your sadness? You take it to the one who is with you always, who knew real sadness himself. So don't worry that he doesn't really comprehend it. Who died and rose again so that your sadness wouldn't have to turn to hopelessness. And trust the truth of Jesus' words to Martha, that whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And I hope that the resurrection makes that connection for you today in the power of comfort that is the power of Jesus Christ in us, because he is the resurrection and the life.